All right. Please join me in welcoming our 45-minute speaker, Kerry O from Los Angeles.
Can I use this? Good evening. My name is Kerry. I'm an alcoholic. I want to say thanks to Anthony for being the secretary of this group and for Raina for the invitation, as well as to Gil. And I want to congratulate the group. I have had home groups in 3 different states and 1 foreign country, which is to say I've been around the block. And this group has achieved a milestone, a significant milestone in Alcoholics Anonymous that you may not be aware of. You are allowed to be in the sanctuary of this church. So congratulations, and don't mess it up. No drinks. My first home group was in the proverbial church basement. There were 14 doors in that church, and the meeting directory said the meeting was in the rear, but there were 2 rears. And I was kind of early, actually, which was not like me at all. But I was also extremely neurotic, and I overthought things. So I went to the 14th door in the back, and that wasn't it. It was this other door, number 1. And so, but I stopped at every single door, all the way around that church. And by the time I got there, the meeting had actually started, and the door was closed and locked. Anyway. My sobriety date is October 21st, 2009, so I'm 14, and my home group is the Pacific Group, and we meet in Culver City near Los Angeles on Wednesdays at 7:30. If you're ever down in that area, it's welcome. It's an open meeting. I think that's it for the statistics and the opening. Oh yeah, that's it. I'm done. That was my experience, strength, and hope. Mike, thank you so much for your 10-minute talk, and hello to Mike's posse. Mike rolls deep. It's good to have an AA posse. I have one. They just didn't come today. Maybe. Welcome to everybody who's new. Congratulations on everybody who celebrated birthdays. We had a good streak going there. Everything was an even year until you over there with the 19 kind of threw it off. We had a 1 and a 1 and a 5 and a 10. I thought it was going to be a perfect thing. But congratulations to everybody. And next year she'll have 20, so that'll be even. I said I'm neurotic, so I like things to be even. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a binge drinker from the age, I'll start. I come from a big Irish Catholic family. I'm 1 of 5 kids born in 7 years. I'm an Irish twin. My brother and I were born in the same year. Like Mike, I come from a loving home that has been proven to have been a good marriage because my parents are still married 56 years later. They were both the children of alcoholics, fathers. And they were from Boston. When in 1975, they moved our entire family, including a baby, which is my brother Brian, who is now a Catholic priest. So just to give you an idea of the sort of what was possible to come out of my household was an actual Catholic priest. That did not happen to me. This is my water. Good. I'm defying the rules. I'm drinking in the sanctuary. Ha ha ha. Yeah, in 1975, we moved to Stockton, California. And, my parents, literally put an entire country between themselves and the ravages of alcoholism. I didn't hear anything about my alcoholic grandparents. One of them was dead, and the other one was extremely jolly whenever I was around. And he used to do this thing where he would pull out all these dollar bills out of his pocket, and if they were slightly soiled or wrinkled or folded or, there was a crease in them, he would just make a big production out of how gross they were, and he would start giving them away to the grandchildren. I have 24 first cousins on that side, so there was a lot of us running around. And I thought that was great, you know, free money from this idiot who thinks that just because it's creased, you know, there's something wrong with it. And it wasn't until much later that the sort of family secrets about alcoholism started coming out. And, you know, in stories like, you know, my grandfather coming home at 2 o'clock in the morning and waking up my mother to make him a sandwich. And that type of thing. And I'm saying this because these were the ideas. So first of all, I'm saying this to say that, you know, my parents, you know, basically put a country between themselves and that. And it actually worked for them. You know, that doesn't work for everybody, but it seems to have worked for them as well as their faith and their sort of devotion to their, you know, to their religion and their community and, of course, to their children. So that's, you know, the basics of how I grew up. I got drunk for the first time when I was 14. We went on a field trip. You guys are from Central Coast, so maybe you know this. There's a ship in San Francisco called the C.A. Thayer. And I guess it's like an old, I don't know, Navy ship or commercial ship. I don't know. And there was a field trip. One of my brother's classes was going on a field trip there, and I went along. Or I don't know. Our whole family went. I don't know why. In the bottom of the ship, my sponsor is a Navy man. And so this drives him nuts the way I talk about this ship. I'm like, yeah, it was in the basement of the ship. I don't know if it has a name, but I'm just like, it's the basement. Anyway, they had this drinks set up. Sodas over here for the kids and beer and wine over here for the adults. It was an overnight field trip. I don't know why. But so I started at the soda table, but then I found myself in the basement of the ship by myself. Nobody was around, no adults. And you know, I'm from a family with five kids and two adults on the, you know, on the, they couldn't do the man-to-man system, but the zone system was in effect. These were, you know, there was people around all the time. I was by myself and I took that red Solo cup and I just sauntered over to that other table. It was the 80s, so it was white Zinfandel wine, and I poured it on top of my orange soda. And I drank that down. And for anybody who's new, you know, here in AA, and especially anybody coming from rehab, I'm sure you learned about what we know today in 2024 about the physical sort of description of alcoholism and, you know, and how it works and what affects the brain and all that kind of stuff. Well, in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1935, the best that the doctor who advised us and we as alcoholics could do was describe the problem with alcoholics and the physical factor of alcoholism. The best we could do was to describe it as an allergy, that there was some abnormal reaction that when alcohol comes into our bodies, it creates an abnormal reaction, which is that we crave more of it. It's also known as the phenomenon of craving in kind of AA lingo. As far as I know, science kind of just affirms that this is what happens. We know more about the why, but the what is described, as my understanding, is described perfectly in the book Alcoholics Anonymous in the chapter called The Doctor's Opinion, written by the foremost alcohol and drug addiction treatment doctor of the time. Well, that day, apparently this happened to me because I just took that red Solo cup and I kept going back to that, pouring in a little red orange soda. So anybody who came by would think I was just a nice girl drinking an orange soda. But I poured more and more Zinfandel wine. I went back four times. I got nice and drunk. And again, the benefit of being from a big family, they cannot do the man-to-man defense. They have to do the zone defense, and nobody noticed. Nobody knew that I was drunk, and I just sort of slithered off to wherever my bed was and went to sleep, and that was that. I drank not that much, but just like that for the next 14 years. So from the age of 14 to 28, I was a binge drinker, which is to say that when I drank, I got drunk. I took it in, that phenomenon of craving came in, and whatever I was planning to do this, to do that, it went away, and I just, you know, I drank and got drunk. I just did not do it that often. I was completely obsessed with school and having the approval of my teachers and my parents and winning awards. This was my absolute thing that I was all about. And, you know, drinking a lot just was not gonna work with those kind of goals. By the time I got to college, I was still like that. I had a boyfriend in college. He was from Russia. And he said that, and I was in so many clubs and I had so many leadership positions. And I was really, I knew when I was a freshman, I knew what all the awards that could be won were. And then I would study the people who had won them. And I was like, I was just intent on like just building that resume and winning those awards. I had a boyfriend from Russia and he told me that I reminded him of the kids that he grew up with in the Young Communist League. And I thought that was a compliment until I remembered that he was a refugee from the Soviet Union and we were basically in a Cold War with them. So that's how things were going. I continued this sort of march of achievement. The 12 and 12 talks about one of the problems of alcoholics is that we have instincts, like all humans. You know, we have to have an instinct in this society to go make money, or we won't be okay. You have to have an instinct to eat, or you'll die of starvation. But it talks about in the 12 how we just take it, we just take it to 11 is our problem, or 14 or 26. We just take it too far. And that was, looking back, and because of the step work that I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous, I can look back on these time periods and I can definitely see being driven so much by pride, by gluttony, by lust, all the things that we talk about in our AA literature. And I went to law school, same thing, pushing. By this time, there were starting to be some cracks in the foundation, and alcohol had, went from being a very occasional thing at socially acceptable occasions, such as bachelorette parties, weddings, or just, the occasional random Friday or Saturday night. And law school, I can look back and see certain things happening that, starts to give some indication of a problem. This one night, I lost basically the entire contents of my wallet, but not the wallet itself. We're extremely skilled, we are. And there were not just one Irish pub, there were two Irish pubs right next to my law school. I blame them. And anyway, so some other patron from these bars, called and, gave me all my stuff back. I brought a present, and I brought the only present that anyone would want, which was a case of beer. That was, I can look back and see that's how I was starting to roll. I finished law school. I had a really cool job. I got basically a grant to start a project, kind of my own thing. I remember being in law school and hearing about like what most people's careers were like and how there was just, this sort of, you could call it apprentice period, or you could call it like a, what happens in fraternities, like a hazing, where you were just kind of chained to your desk for 12 hours a day for 4 years, just looking at documents. And again, back to these instincts that I have and these, being just driven beyond their natural purpose, I was just like, that is not for me. And by the way, those people make good money doing that. But that was not for me. I said, I want to get in the mix immediately. I want clients. I want to be in court. I want to do everything. And so I got this grant that then paid me. It has been confirmed, I was the lowest paid lawyer in all of Washington, D.C., where there are 75,000 lawyers, more per square mile than anywhere on the planet. But I was, it's like it talks about in Bill's story, like the drive was on. And, I was getting what I wanted in terms of the work that I wanted to do and the attention that I wanted to get, the attention being much more important than the work. And it was during this time that I, basically kind of found myself outside of the school environment for the first time in, 16 years. And I had my evenings free for the first time. even though I love to work, you know, late into the night and send emails to let everybody know I was working late. I had a little bit more freedom. And it was during this time period that my drinking really started to pick up. And I actually also had a lot of rules about drinking, you know, having the knowledge that I had about my two alcoholic grandfathers and just, you know, my goals and everything. I didn't drink twice, you know, not to mention being an alcoholic. I didn't drink twice on the weekends. I didn't keep alcohol in my house. I didn't drink alone. And within about 3 years, all those rules were just out the window. And I was definitely drinking, you know, probably at that time, you know, 4 to 5 days a week on the regular. I started a happy hour for people kind of in my field. And this was like, I was just telling someone about this the other day, like a youngin. It would have been like 1999, and I had dial-up internet, and I found like a program on that internet that was basically like a voicemail system where, I basically had this whole voicemail system with press 1 and 2 and 3, and I would give out the location of this happy hour like every week. I was exercising my leadership skills in the alcoholism category, the alcohol category anyway. And I have to tell you that for those first 3 years, it really was amazing. And those were some of the best years of my life. And the vocabulary that I have now in Alcoholics Anonymous to describe that is that before that, I was completely locked in the bondage of self. And that looked like all kinds of things, of being concerned about what people thought about me, who was talking about me, who was thinking about me, what I was thinking about other people, being extremely judgmental, but also extremely fearful about what other people were doing, thinking, and saying. Pretty much all the time in every area of life, at work, in romance, in friendships, and in my family. Who, by the way, you know, I can see now work 100% in my corner, and mostly, for the most part, you know, well, spiritually adjusted, healthy people. And I could not see that. I saw them as extremely hostile. I like to find, you know, the 6 things that my parents did wrong in the 18 years that I lived in their house and just go on and on about them at the bar, not at the bar, at the therapist's office, etc. Today I know I was basically just living in the wrong neighborhood. I was living in victimhood. And I believe today that victims don't get to stay sober. And I try really hard to, focus on the positive. And that's not to say that I wasn't a victim of something and that people in AA are not victims of things. We are. But I need, you know, for me, I need to move on. Move on from that. At any rate, that's what I was doing at those times. And after about 3 years, things started to take a bit of a darker turn. And for the next 8 years, I would descend into active alcoholism and all the consequences that come with that. And during that time period, I was absolutely also trying to find solutions. I knew something was wrong with me anyway, all the time. And then, you know, to be doing that much drinking and to be having so many consequences, most of them internal, I wanted a fix for that. I wanted a fix and a solution. And so I was doing lots of things to try to fix myself, and I was going to therapy, but then I would quit the therapist so I could afford to go on vacation. And, I would go on these, I went on this one vacation one time at the very last minute with some, you know, rich lawyer friends who didn't take the, you know, the self-righteous path where I could be in charge of everything that I did. They were actually, you know, just working and making a lot of money. Anyway, they were all going to Turkey, and I said, I'm not going to go. You know, Father Martin is somebody who has, was an AA member and gave talks outside of AA called Chalk Talks, and you can see them on YouTube. And one of the things he talks about is one problem of the alcoholic is living emotion over intellect. And that's definitely true of me. At any rate, this was a decision I made, intellect over emotion. My rich friends are going to Turkey. I am poor. I cannot go. I am not going. But in the lead up to this trip, and everybody's talking about it, and this is what they're doing, and they're going to do this, and they're getting a boat, and this and that and the other thing. And by the time it came, it flipped to E over I. I can't not go. I can't have them be gone. I can't have them come back and talking about this. So what do I, I'm booking a last minute ticket. It's really expensive, credit card debt, blah, blah, blah. I go over there. My head is just constantly running about the things that people are doing at work, the people who are for me, which is not very many, the people who are against me, which is a lot of people, the things that they are doing. I'm never looking at what did I do? What did I say? What amend might I have to make? And it's so crazy to think about the way that I live now and doing a 10 step, every day looking at these things and to the best of my ability, cleaning them up usually within 24 hours. And just to think about how, whatever this was, an 11 year period where I am just bulldozing through life, doing none of this. And so everything's everybody else's fault. So it's all going on in my head. And I go to this vacation where you get this boat over on the Mediterranean, just completely quiet, tranquil, just the sea and good friends. And my head did not shut off until Wednesday morning. And on Wednesday, I had an extremely peaceful day of just being in the present, enjoying my friends, enjoying the surroundings. And then Thursday morning, I woke up, it's almost time to go back to work, and it started right up again. That is what I was capable of, and that's the length that I had to go to just to have one day of peace. So of course I was gonna drink through all of that. Of course I was gonna drink, because at least then for those few, maybe hour and a half, between 6 o'clock and 7:30, when I had those first bourbons, those first half to one entire bottle of wine, that it would shut, my brain would shut off, and I would have a little bit of peace. And so, like I said, I was looking for solutions for that. I went to therapy. I quit the therapy to go on this vacation and the other things. I quit a job without another job just to let everybody know how horrible these people I was that I was working with. Nobody cared. That night, actually, I threw my own going away party. Nobody threw one for me, so I threw my own. And then I invited like all these, I thought I was such a mover and a shaker, a DC person. And so I invited, everyone even more prestigious who they were, I invited them. And hardly anybody came. Who came were my close friends, my drinking buddies. And I just was in a heap in the floor, in the car, having to be poured into the car, crying, ugly crying, and saying, nobody cares, nobody cares. This was around 2005 or 2006. And I had a very rudimentary cell phone, not even a flip phone. Remember those phones that were just like, just a brick, right? And you had to text, by pressing the A key. If you wanted to text a C, as in nobody cares, you needed the C, you would press the one key three times. Anyway, somehow completely drunk and completely despondent, I text my father, who lives in Texas. It's one or two in DC. This means it's 2 or 3 a.m. in Texas, where my dad lives. And I text, no explanation, just nobody cares. The next day he calls, he says, he's never received a text message in his entire life. So this is how he described it. I got an email from you on my phone. So that was how I introduced my dad to texting. So like I said, I quit jobs to try to make myself feel better. I even told my partner at the time, you just watch me. You see me miserable in this job and complaining every day and complaining about all these people. Just watch me. When I'm in this other job, I'm going to be so happy. I was not. And another thing I tried was self-help books. I love the self-help books. I'm a reader, a bookworm. And so, yeah, when I don't feel good, I am definitely going to go for a book. Sometimes I'll even go to the bookstore and go to that section and just look at the spines, try to diagnose myself. boundaries, maybe anger, yes. Anyway, and so amongst the books that I got and tried the quizzes and the things and felt better, sometimes for a couple hours, sometimes for a couple of weeks, a definitive checklist and a program to take, you know, to reform your life. And, you know, but after 3 weeks, either I would stop doing it or the thing would stop working. And so some of those books that I got were The Anger Trap. Then I got The Anger Trap for Women. If I apply a gender approach to my situation, maybe it will be better. It wasn't. And in 2009, I got a book called Take Back Your Life with Outlook. And it wasn't like Take Back Your Life with like a sunny outlook on life. It was Take Back Your Life with Microsoft Outlook. Which, if you're not an office worker, is basically an email calendar program. And really, it was like, oh yeah, if I could just put everything into the computer and color code it and put it in order and then just, you know, do those things, like I will be okay. That was one of those that lasted for like 4 weeks. I felt I had a Microsoft Outlook high for about 4 weeks. But it didn't work. You know, by this time I'm drinking 6 days a week, 7 days a week. Sometimes I'm taking Sundays off, not out of, you know, celebrating the Sabbath or, you know, any kind of virtue or trying to get ready for the week at work. Sometimes I just was truly physically spent from the activity that I was doing. I was a weeknight bar drinker. Closing time in DC is 2 a.m. And so that's what I would just do. I was there, you know, till 2 a.m., sometimes come home and keep going. Did not know, again, about that phenomenon of craving. Why am I sitting at my kitchen table by myself drinking blue Curacao? Because that's all I have in the house, you know, that we bought once for one kind of cocktail. Or agua ardiente, which is like every country has that licorice flavored, you know, alcohol. That's the one, I guess, of Central America. I mean, why? And then I would even have these fantasies of like, I had this nice stemware, mid-century modern stemware, and I would, you know, get some ice and I would be sipping on my agua ardiente and I would imagine I could be in the Washington Post style section, you know, agua ardiente, the new drink for spring by Carrie. Maybe put some sugar on the rim, you know, I mean, just delusional. You know, and what I know now is just a physical reaction, the phenomenon of craving. That first Yingling I had in Slam before I walked out the door, I didn't even know the word pre-gaming until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, but that's what I was doing. Go to the bar, do all my shenanigans, come home, and just keep going. I wasn't ready to pass out, and I would just keep going. That's alcoholism. That's the physical factor of alcoholism. I had no idea. And so that's how things were going. In 2007, oh, I forgot this other part. The one other thing that I tried, I mentioned that I would quit jobs, change relationships, but I actually changed my location in about 2003. And I just decided that, now mind you, I'm a workaholic and I have been since I was like six. So I'm a workaholic, but what I diagnose is that Washington, D.C. is the problem, and it's too workaholic, and it's, you know, whatever, and I have to get out. And so I got out, and I moved to Armenia. Yeah. For anybody who's new, this is the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and you'll hear a lot of us, we hear us talk about the first 164 pages, which is, you know, where the program of action is. So that's just that. So how did we get this big book? With you know, if that's where our thing ends, is 164. Well, the rest of this book is stories, personal stories written by various people, you know, over the last 80 years of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of these stories, an AA genius coined or wrote down something that she heard in an AA meeting, the term geographical cure. And geographical cure, if you're not familiar with it, means I take myself from one place to another trying to cure the symptoms of my alcoholism. But the problem is, of course, is that I have brought myself with me. So at any rate, I challenge you to find somebody who took a geographical cure farther than mine, Washington, D.C. to Armenia. And I'm also here to report that geographical cures absolutely work. They work for the first 30 days before you take them, and the 30 days after you arrive to your destination. And it is true. For those 30 days before I went, I was feeling good, you know. It's gonna be so great over there, and I'm getting out of workaholic Washington, it's gonna be amazing. And then I landed there, and I was like, oh, this is amazing. And there's these like crazy winds that happen in Armenia, and it was like so refreshing, and the tomatoes were delicious, and you know, just everything was like, this was such a good idea. But then on day 30 plus one, it all just came back. I was working there, and I was working with the same kind of dumb, idiotic people that I was working with back in DC, people who don't know how to operate the printer in the office. You know, I wasn't getting the proper respect that I deserved, and so forth and so on. And so it was just right back on. My dark and negative nature was just right there. And of course, there was a ton of alcohol. If you ever have a slippy poo, and you find yourself in that part of the world, I highly recommend Armenia. Number one, the Armenians don't really drink that much. Number two, when you're an expat, you're basically like, well, you're definitely, and you're a woman, you're like a third gender. This actually was explained to me. I was like, well, is it gonna be safe there for me as a woman? They were like, well, there's three genders, male, female, and expat. So, you know, you're just gonna be fine. They think of you as just a separate category. And it's completely true. I behaved so badly. I had a Chinese restaurant right below my apartment. I went in there multiple times, just completely wasted. Could not even articulate what I wanted. I would just stand there and stare at them. You know, and they were just like, oh, the American. I for sure had the Armenians on my four-step. Anybody who's new in our four-step, we catalog our resentments. I definitely had resentments against the Armenians, and I was complaining about them full-time by the time I left. And I had to acknowledge then in my eighth-step, which for anybody who's new is a list of people that we made that we harmed, and my sponsor advised me that it was not just people. And same with resentments, that it wasn't just people that I could be resentful against. I could be resentful against institutions like, say, the Catholic Church or the IRS or whatever. And to be thorough, I was encouraged to look at all those things, and so I did. And so when it came to the eighth step, I had to acknowledge that I had caused harm to the Armenians as a people in general. You know, by a show of hands, how many of you know somebody who's been to Armenia? Not that you know an Armenian, I know some of you are from the Valley, so, but that you know someone who has been to Armenia. Not being Armenian, having been to the country of Armenia. Okay, it's like four people. Anyway, that's typical. That's typical. Nobody, you know, whatever. And I came back and I, spouted all my horrible stories, focusing on the dark and negative, of course, about how horrible the Armenians were, et cetera, et cetera. I caused them harm. My amends is, do not talk about the Armenians. So please don't ask me about that after the meeting, and don't tempt me to, because it's a living amends. I'm 14 years into it, and I'm doing well. Don't tempt me, please. But in Armenia, they have this beer called Kataik, and it's almost like a 40. It's very large, and it has everything you would want in a beer. It's a large bottle. It's available everywhere, all the time, on Sundays, at 2 o'clock in the morning, everywhere. As a beer, it has more alcohol than regular beer. I don't know, 15%, 17%, it has a lot of alcohol in it. And it's this big, it's 50 cents. What more could you want? And it's tasty, it's tasty. Anyway. They got that going for them. What they do not have in Armenia, which was a big problem for me, they do not have Maker's Mark bourbon. That was my drink. That was my thing. That was my jam. I've been to Loretto, Kentucky. I've been on a pilgrimage. My mother goes on pilgrimages to Medjugorje and other, you know, Catholic pilgrims around the world. I took a pilgrimage to Loretto, Kentucky. I got to dip my own bottle into the red wax. I got a little certificate. I was ambassador. I went in 2000, and that must have been 1999, like right after I graduated from law school, and they aged their bourbon for 10 years. And so I got my name on a barrel, and they were going to let me know when it aged. And it aged in 2009, November 2009, I was 1 month sober. But I wasn't really sure I was going to stay in AA. And they sent me this poster, and it was like a swimsuit model Maker's Mark bottle. It was like, she was like wet and, you know, everything. And, you know, like drip, water dripping off of it. I mean, it was well lit. It was a great poster. And I just came back from my home group. That came in the mail. I just like curled it up and put it over there because maybe I was going to go back to drinking. I'll get into that. Anyway, they did not have Maker's Mark in Armenia, except for they did have it at the airport, at the duty-free. Now, in Armenia, all the flights come in at 3 o'clock in the morning. Every single one, no matter where it's coming from, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. It's also a custom in Armenia to go meet people at the airport. There's no such thing as, oh, you're coming? Well, take a taxi and I'll meet you at your hotel in the morning. That is not a thing. So I used to go out with the people at the bar, and people would be like, oh, I got to go to the airport. My boss is coming. My mom's coming, or whatever. And then anyone want to go, and I would just be like, I do! Because then I would go and get my Maker's Mark. And again, have no idea about the phenomenon of craving, so I would go, okay, well, I'm not going to be back here for like 2 months, so how many bottles do I need? Like, three? Yeah, I'll make it last, I'll spread it out. No. I could take it home, I start, phenomenon of craving kicks in, those three bottles are gone in like 3 days. So, anyway, I come back from Armenia and, you know, and I was there for a year. I come back and, you know, just kept on going. And, you know, my drinking is picking up. My obsession with what other people are doing, what other people are saying, it's just constant. My head is extremely busy and I'm trying. I'm really trying. In 2007, I finally honed in on that maybe alcohol was contributing to the problem. I didn't drink for about a day and my hands started to shake. I thought I had Parkinson's disease. I went on the internet and ruled that out. I was actually disappointed and eventually looked up the symptoms of alcohol withdrawal and alcoholism. And you know what I found there, and this also is all over our literature, is that the difference between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic, you know, even the alcoholic and the heavy drinker, who can look like an alcoholic by the way that they behave and the amount that they drink, but the difference is who can control it. In the big book, this simple definition, do you find that when you start you cannot control the amount you take, or when you try to stop you can't? That's the sort of two-part alcoholism definition in our book. And I didn't know that. Remember, I've got the grandfather who wakes people up at 2 o'clock in the morning to make them a sandwich. That was not me. I lived alone, first of all. And, whatever. I didn't do that. And now, remember, I don't drink at all, really, for 14 years, occasionally at socially acceptable occasions. And then, you know, from 28 onwards, I'm a mess, but I'm just getting started. I'm making up for lost time. I've been a huge nerd my whole life. I'm finally living life. I'm enjoying myself. I have money and a career, so I'm not hurting anybody. I'm not running my life into the ground. This can't be me. So I said, okay. Control drinking. I never tried that. You know, I just didn't drink that much for 14 years. For the last 8 years, I've been doing whatever I want. But okay, now I know. I have self-knowledge. That's what I'll do. So I went on the, I love the internet. And I went back to the internet and looked up, okay, well, what does it mean? What does it mean to control your drinking? And what does it mean to have a moderate drinking situation? So the U.S. government website said 3 drinks in a day for women. I'm Irish. Ireland is next to the United Kingdom. So I went to the United Kingdom website, which says for women, 5 drinks. Now, let's talk about measurements. This is barely 1. I have a 20-ounce water bottle with myself today. That is 1. So 5 of those, I could do that. And that's what I decided to do. But then I didn't even do that. I didn't even remember. I didn't even keep track. It was a year and a half, just fast forward again, just descending. I became depressed. I started becoming anxious. I was claustrophobic. I got put on probation at my job. I got sent to anger management classes by my job twice. And remember, the work and the job, that's all I have. That's my thing. My love life is a complete disaster. I have complete failure to launch in that department. Nothing is happening. I'm having one night stands, or I'm having incredible fantasy relationships in my head that go nowhere. but I do okay in my career. I get some attention and some success, and I work a lot. I work till 10, and then I go to the bar, and I wake up at 9, get to my office by 9:30. My hair was 1 inch short all the way around. I like to keep things extremely simple. I wore men's hair product. I own one pair of pants and 5 shirts. All the shirts have pizza stains on them. I told you I used to come home and drink agua ardiente. I would also order a pizza and then spill it all over myself. I was morbidly obese, about 70 pounds heavier than I am now. And I said, at this year and a half later, I just kind of came to again, and all those things have amassed, and this was in the beginning of 2009. And this is also the time I found that book, that Microsoft Outlook book, and I was putting everything into the computer, and I was trying to get over. Anyway, I started doing a program I found on the internet, of course, called Moderation Management. We were talking about this at dinner. And thank you to the group for having the dinner. Thank you, everybody who came to the dinner. I love to fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. The meeting before the meeting after the meeting, absolutely critical to me in my first many years of sobriety, and still critical. That's a place, it's a place of 12-step work. It's a sacred place. One alcoholic talking to another. And so that's what we did tonight before this meeting. I believe everyone's invited, so I encourage you to go. They meet at 6 o'clock, and the restaurant was good. End of commercial. So I'm doing the program of moderation management, which I found on the internet, which says count your drinks for 30 days, and I did that. Then I did nothing else for maybe 6 more months. Now it's August, and things are just worse and getting worse. And, I'm in that state that I described to you. I was at the beach in Delaware, which is kind of where DC people go to the beach. And I woke up, and somebody was asking me what my last drink was at the meeting, and I actually mixed it up. Friday night was bourbon. Saturday night was this big bottle of white wine, and I poured the rest of it out. And I went for a walk on the beach, and I brought a book with me, and the book was from the Mayo Clinic, and the book was called Depression. Because what better way to get over depression than reading a book about depression? But that's what I did. And in the middle of it was a chapter called Alcohol and Depression. And in that chapter, and I was really going to skip this chapter. Now, mind you, I've got my Outlook list to fix my life, take back my life. And this one of the things was get over depression. And one of the things this book did was, if you were stuck on something, the key was to break it down into smaller things and to keep breaking it into smaller things until you could find something that you could do. And I actually think that's pretty good advice. And it's probably something that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. If I have a problem and I go to my sponsor and, whatever, the broad solution doesn't work, my sponsor will definitely break it down like that and give me something smaller to do. And I'm grateful for that. It's worked. So what I was doing to get over depression was to read this book. And so when I came to that chapter, I really was like, this isn't relevant. I am depressed 23 hours a day, except for when I pour my bourbon, except for when I have that first glass of red wine at the bar with the ladies. Then my depression lifts. And so this is not relevant. But I remembered my little Outlook thing, and I went ahead and read the chapter. And inside that chapter, it said, no one knows whether people get depressed because they drink or people drink because they're depressed. But if you don't stop, you won't know. I heard that. And so I decided to go ahead and move on to step 2 of moderation management, which is don't drink for 30 days and think about why you drink. So I did that. And I was completely nuts during that month. My car got stolen. I left the key in the cup holder and did not lock the door. So it was really more borrowed. But like, you know, and so then I'm like driving all around DC to the police station, trying to find my car, driving around with my friend, you know, just looking for my car. We actually found it. But it was distracting me from thinking about not drinking. And so anyway, I made it those 30 days. But at 30 plus one, step three of that program is slowly introduce alcohol back into your life and kind of see what you can handle. And at 30 plus one, I was just like, I don't think that's it. I don't think that's it. So, but I need something else. This is not an internet solvable problem. So I made an appointment I had a therapist, but I went ahead and made an appointment with a substance abuse counselor. And I was in Washington, D.C. You know, there's a lot of universities in Washington, D.C., but the most prestigious is Georgetown, known to everyone. She was at Georgetown. She said, well, I don't take your insurance. I can't see you for 3 weeks, and you're going to have to pay cash. It's going to be $250. And I thought, and this is where my snobbery comes in handy, because I was like, that's amazing. Yes, I want you. I want you. You don't take my stupid insurance. You can't see me for 3 weeks. That's great. And so I was totally bought in to whatever she was going to say. And so I went to that appointment with her. And at the end of that appointment, she suggested that I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, in this book, and for anybody who's in general service, you know that we have a strong, and general service just means service beyond the group level in AA. We have a strong history of cooperation with the professional community. It's in this book and in a bunch of other books. Cooperate, never criticize. We as alcoholics can do things that professionals cannot do. One alcoholic talking to another is the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the backbone. It's the thing. It's the code that got cracked in 1935. But the doctors can do things too, and they can, you know, wastely like refer people to us. Anyway, so she referred me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so grateful for all those people that came before so that that could happen. I went to my first meeting that night. I met people who were armed with facts about their condition. They were enthusiasts who went to fellowship after every meeting. Every Thursday they went out for coffee and they invited me. I went, they talked about the way they felt. They talked about the way they drank. They didn't talk about the phenomenon of craving. They didn't use the word allergy or, you know, start quoting the doctor's opinion. They just told stories. But they talked about wanting to stop. They talked about how one of their girlfriends who was non-alcoholic went to a bar, you know, those bars where you have like the 7-page beer menu, like that kind of a place. And she looked at the whole thing. And this guy, he was a great storyteller, and he turns every page, and she's looking at every page. I'm like, yeah, which one she's going to pick? I mean, Germany, South Africa. I really like the beer called Delirium Tremens. That's my favorite. No irony, just whatever. I know what that is now. Go through the whole menu and he says, I'll have a Diet Coke. And I mean, they had me. I just went, what? I mean, the injustice, the inhumanity. You know, they had me. They knew. And that's how they spoke the language of the heart to me, telling stories like that. I got a sponsor in that group, and that sponsor started taking me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Steps 1 through 3, what he really emphasized was, look, just to get an understanding of what we're dealing with here. We talked about the physical factor of alcoholism, but we also talked about the spiritual malady. And what does that look like to have a spiritual malady? And, you know, in my case, I had so many symptoms of the spiritual malady, of being, you know, angry, being depressed, being anxious, being contrary. My sponsor told me I was the most contrary person he had ever met. I said, no, I'm not. We moved on to step 4. I cataloged my resentments. Talked about a little bit about that with the Armenians and some other things that were going on. I did all that. Moved on to the fears. The fears, you know, put them down on paper. What I found through that process was I had these incredibly contradictory fears that were causing a total short circuit in my head. For example, I'm afraid to check my work email on the weekends because there might be an emergency and I'm going to have to do something about it. I'm afraid not to check my work email on the weekends because there might be an emergency and when I come in on Monday, they're going to be mad at me. That's a dilemma. Those are both two legitimate fears, but like they cannot exist in the same place. And so, you know, just for anybody who's new, these are the kinds of like things that we do, getting down to causes and conditions. And that's what I did. And in that fifth step, I talked to my sponsor in the 12 and 12, it talks about how, you know, the fifth step, part of the fifth step is to get advice and counsel from somebody. Spiritual matters should not be undertaken alone. It's a dangerous thing, it says. And, you know, my sponsor said, yeah, with your position, check the email a couple times on the weekends, but if it's not an emergency, don't do anything about it until Monday. That was my new idea. I had a lot of old ideas, but that was my new idea, and I got to walk out, you know, more of a free person. Did those amends, and now do steps 10, 11, and 12. In the last 13 years, 14 years, you know, living the AA way of life, you know, was able to get my career back on track. I ended up getting a job that required a presidential appointment. I did not get in trouble at that job. The scrapes I got in, I made amends the next day, and there were not that many of them. I got awards in that job, so finally getting what I want. And was able to start my own business about 7 years ago. I have extreme amount of flexibility, a really easy, soft life. I can work with who I want to work with. When people are too spiritual malady, I just leave them as clients. I just move on. I don't fight. I've ceased fighting anything or anyone. And I have a really peaceful life because of that is what enabled me to move out here to Southern California 3 years ago. For anybody who's new, if you be alcoholic, Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of action. It's a spiritual program. There's people here to help you. They want to help you. It's part of their recovery to help you. Ask one of them. Get a sponsor. Work those steps. And then get on to that last one where you help other people. It's a great way of life. And thanks again for the invitation.
Please give Carrie another round of applause.